So what happens when Jesus walks into your story? What happens when you suddenly encounter Jesus? What happens when Jesus interrupts the trajectory of your entire life? Well, it can completely and utterly change everything. Listen, as a pastor, I've seen it. Sometimes your life collides with Jesus in sort of mysterious ways. Years ago, a woman called the church office and said, you know, I don't go to your church. I don't know anybody up there. I don't even know why I'm calling this church, but I need to talk to somebody. Can I just come up there and talk to somebody? We thought at first she just needed some food or assistance of some kind, but no. She came to the church, just walked in the office and said, this morning I was out walking. I'm not a churchgoer. I'm not religious at all. But when I was walking, God spoke to me and told me that he wanted me to be his disciple. She said, what do I do with that? I said, I don't know. Go down to Holy Trinity, maybe. I didn't say that. But you know, you think evangelism, it's going to be so hard, right? And she just walks right in the office and basically says, Jesus called me. See, it's mysterious. Sometimes it happens in almost bizarre ways. A guy once told me that in high school, he wasn't a Christian, wasn't raised in a Christian home, but he told me he had once smoked so much pot that when he slept that night, he had gotten addicted to pot and using pot morning and night, so much so that that night he went to bed and he had the worst, the most horrible nightmares, and Satan was chasing him and Satan was after him and Satan had got him. And when he woke up from all this, he said, that's it, I'm done. I am done with pot forever. I've got to go meet Jesus. And so that morning, he got up, drove to a church closest to his house, talked with a youth pastor, and eventually he met Jesus. Yeah, bizarre, right? And by the way, that young man was me, actually. But I'm telling you, I hear it all the time, and I encounter it in any manner of ways. Jesus interrupts. Sometimes it's in ordinary ways. You know, at Christmas Eve, this past Christmas Eve, this guy was, he was drugged here by his family to come to the Christmas Eve service. Not a Christian, apparently. Not a fan of the church either. But he wrote me a letter. Yeah, he wrote me a letter the day after Christmas. And he said, I so enjoyed your meditation about the baby Jesus last night. He said, the more I thought about it, I realized I need to completely rethink my whole opinion about Jesus. This is a big step for me, he said, and for that, Pastor, I thank you. Just a 10-minute meditation about the baby Jesus. You know, not even a full-length legitimate sermon, you know. And Jesus interrupts. So that's what we're going to talk about this morning and really throughout Lent. What happens when your life collides with Jesus? Because here are four ordinary fishermen. They're just plying their craft. They're just making a buck. It's an ordinary day. They're fishing. And Jesus walks right into their story, and he changes the entire trajectory of their lives. He changes everything about them. I mean, they're nobodies. I mean, the most apt description of a nobody is to say that you're a Galilean. It's like saying you're from Oakdale. A Galilean, you know. And not only are you a Galilean, you're a fisherman. These are not important people. These are not prominent people. These aren't anything like that. A Galilean fisherman. Jesus walks right into their world. And so that now we know that they're regarded as among some of the most famous men who have ever walked the face of the earth. Peter, Andrew, James, John, St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, St. Andrew's, the birthplace of golf. More children in all the world are named after these guys, these four fishermen, all because Jesus walked into their life. Until very recently, we even had a Peter's place down in Bridgeville, right? I think that was a different Peter, but anyhow, when Jesus walks into your life, it changes everything. So that's the question this morning. Has your life been interrupted by Jesus? I'm not asking if do you know him. I'm asking, are you a follower? Completely different. You ready to go? Got a sermon outline? Here we go. Point number one. When Jesus encounters these four fishermen, he summons them. There is a summons. He says, follow me. So what does this mean, follow me? You have to understand, this is a rabbi. Jesus is a rabbi. He's a teacher, and he is inviting them to be his students. He is saying to these fishermen, fishing isn't going to be the primary thing that defines your life anymore. You are going to be my apprentice, and I want you to join my school and do life with me. Students of the rabbi, they didn't go into a classroom, hear lectures, and take a few notes. It didn't work that way. It was peripatetic learning. It's Socratic learning, asking questions, answering questions. They lived with the rabbi. They ate with the rabbi. They walked with the rabbi. Rabbi constantly, asking questions of the rabbi. They watched the rabbi interact with other people. They absorbed everything the rabbi had to offer. Listen, Jesus didn't come to teach here and there, work a few miracles, die and rise again. He came to create a cadre of followers by which he would then form his church, lead his church, all to be the visible, tangible presence of his person on earth. You know, when he departed, he said, it's good that I should leave. It's good. Well, it didn't seem good to those who were following him, right? He says, it's good that I leave, for I will send my Holy Spirit. Because you see, Jesus could only be Jesus as a body. He could only be physically present in one place. But to be omnipresent, the Spirit has to come. The Spirit of Jesus comes and is scattered all over the world, all under the leadership of those Jesus first trained, and four fishermen were among them. Now, what's surprising about this summons is that usually students would pursue the rabbi, and students would ask the rabbi if they could be tutored and mentored by them, but that's not what happens here, is it? No, Jesus pursues. Jesus finds and selects them, and he doesn't select them because they're bright. He doesn't pick them because they're brave. He doesn't pick them for any other reason other than his own will and choosing. Nothing in them makes them the choice products for this selection, but it's Jesus who takes the initiative. You know, as Presbyterians, we're familiar with John 15. You did not choose me, but I chose you, Jesus says, and I appointed you to go and to bear much fruit. Now, you need to understand, this is not an invitation. Jesus doesn't walk past these four guys in the midst of them doing their job and say, I'd really like for you guys to consider something. And, I'd like you to take a few days to think about it. I'm going to present my best case, and then you decide if you're in or out. That's not what this is. It's a summons. Jesus said simply, follow me. I'm not asking. I'm telling. When Jesus went to a demon-possessed person, did he say to the demon-possessed person, I'd really like for you to release this person. I'd really like for you to come. That's what I'd prefer. That's not how the incident went down at all. Jesus says, come out. He orders the demon out. And so Jesus says to them, follow me. They're being summoned. Jesus is simply taking possession of what belongs to him. And so a government, what happens when a nation is threatened and wartime is upon them? The government can say to the farmers, the produce of your farm now belongs to us. We've got soldiers to feed. And by the way, your factory, the place where you used to make cars, we are not going to make cars anymore. You're going to make tanks, you're going to make planes or whatever. The government can go out and say, this now belongs to us because the need is that critical. And the government can even say to men or women, guess what? You were going to college. You had aims. You had plans for your life. Guess what? You now belong to the U.S. military. You can be requisitioned for service by the government. And so the king has walked into this world. He walks by four fishermen and says, come with me. I made you. I own you. You belong to me. Listen, this is un-American as you can imagine. This just runs right in the face of our highest American values, which are, we're sovereign, we have rights, I've told you before that the flag of the state of Virginia has a woman, and her foot is on the throat of the king with those words, "Sic semper tyrannis," death to tyrants always. Freedom, nobody tells us what to do. And so in the Bible, we see Jesus tell a little boy, "Give me your lunch," and he feeds thousands. Jesus can say to the disciples, "I need your boat." And so he stands there in the bow of the boat so that he can preach to the people on the shore. Jesus can say to the disciples, "I want you to go into town, and I want you to find a donkey that's never been ridden on. I want you to untie that donkey, and I want you to bring it to me." Now, who might have a problem with that? The owner of the donkey, right? Who are these Galileans who think they can walk into town and take someone else's beasts, right? And Jesus says, if anybody asks you what in the world you're doing, simply say, "The Lord hath need of it." The creator of the donkey, the maker of the donkey, the real owner of everything that exists has need of it. But you see, you and I, we're not used to that view of God. You see, our basic view of God is that he exists for us, right? I mean, you'd be crazy to do life without God. He could be very useful, right? He could be very helpful. Not the idea that he alone is the sovereign Lord of the universe who can say to us, "Follow me." The command of Jesus is irresistible, and immediately they follow. Again, it's amazing because oftentimes people will say, "I had no interest in becoming a Christian at all." And then suddenly God interrupts my life and I followed him. Yeah, I thought Christianity is for, you know, ignorant bozos. Yeah, I think it's for people who are uneducated. I think it's for people who haven't studied science, you know, or the great thinking of the world. I could never be a Christian, and then they become a Christian. The command of Jesus is irresistible. In fact, when we see Jesus for who he really is, to do anything other than to follow him, well, it appears absurd. It becomes a no-brainer. And so my question for you this morning is, have you been summoned? Have you been summoned? I love what C.S. Lewis says, the university professor, the Oxford Don, who describes the day he's traveling on a bus, and he says this: "Without words, a fact about myself was somehow presented to me. I became aware that I was holding something at bay or shutting something out. I felt myself being given a free choice. I could open up the door, I could keep it shut. I could unbuckle the armor, or I could keep it on. Neither choice was presented as a duty. No threat or promise was attached to it either, though I knew that to open the door meant the incalculable. I chose to open, to unbuckle, to loosen the rein. I say chose, yet it did not really seem possible to do the opposite." You hear what I'm saying? We choose him who has already chosen us. And so this is the question for you. Are you a disciple? Are you a follower of Jesus? Have you been summoned? Second, then, how then do we respond to this summons? How do we respond? Well, there's submission, right? It's pretty amazing. They left immediately, at once. It keeps saying over and over, they dropped their nets, they left their boats. James and John left their dad in the boat. They left their crew. It was a decisive act of radical, exclusive commitment to Jesus, submitting every area of their life, right? They have a vocation. They're fishermen. Their grandfathers were fishermen. Their fathers were fishermen. They are fishermen. Their kids are going to be fishermen. Their grandkids are going to be fishermen. They're fishermen. That's what they do. And yet they dropped it all. They dropped their vocational plans and they followed Jesus. Even in a culture where to leave your father and go follow another was radical commitment. That's what they did. It was a radical act of exclusive commitment, submitting their lives to Jesus. You see, they're making Jesus boss. They're making Jesus their priority. They're making Jesus the agenda setter of their life. It's the New Testament version of Abraham, right? Abraham is a pagan. He's an idol worshiper. And God says, "I want you. You're going to be the father of my people. I'm going to take you out of this land. I'm going to take you to a land that you do not know, but I will go with you. Drop everything and come with me. And he did. That's what these four fishermen are asked to do. To be a Jesus follower is to yield. Now listen, it doesn't mean perfect obedience. No, these guys weren't perfectly obedient, were they? We read all about it in the Gospels. We read all about their failures and their foibles and their lack of faith, right? It doesn't mean perfect obedience. It means, though, I've made the decision to follow Christ. I yield. And he's the boss. We don't always like the boss. We don't always do what the boss says. But we acknowledge that he's the boss. He's the king. He's the ruler. And so I yield. Now again, this is not the North American ideal. In North American Christianity, we have this idea, I will follow, but... I will follow, but on my terms. Yes, I'm all about Jesus as long as you give me a happy marriage. But if my marriage isn't any good, I reserve the right to walk away from it, whether you say that's kosher or not. Because ultimately, it's about my happiness, and I think you recognize that, Jesus. And so if you're not coming through for my happiness, the contract's kind of broken, right? I'll follow you, but if the person I want to marry or have a serious relationship isn't a believer, well, you love who you love, And this is who I love, and even if the Bible says I shouldn't be yoked to an unbeliever in marriage, I'm doing it. You see what I mean? I'm a follower as long as God behaves. As long as God does what I want him to do, well, I'm a follower. Well, that's not the way it works. I will follow you, but that tithing thing, that's not going to happen. Are you crazy? It's my money. It's not yours. See, we kind of got a problem, right? The whole idea of saying, I yield, but not really. I love the story of Peter. Peter is a strong-willed, strong-headed leader type. And even before Peter is summoned, you remember what happened? They'd been fishing all night. They had been fishing all night and they got nothing. Squat. Imagine that. All that hard, back-breaking labor involved with that. Throwing out the nets, pulling them back in, throwing them out, pulling them back in, over and over and over. Thankfully, the sun finally comes up. They're mending their nets. They're cleaning their nets as they had to do, but they got nothing. And then the preacher shows up. And the preacher has an idea. He says, put your nets back in the water again, only put them on the other side of the boat. What do you think Peter would have thought about that? You're in construction, you're building a house, you've poured the foundation, you got the walls going up, and suddenly the preacher drives up and says, I think I would do this differently. Let's put these walls up over here. What's that contractor going to say? I do houses, you do God stuff. Stay in your lane, preacher, right? Peter would say, what in the world? I've worked my tail off, and now you're sending me back out? You don't know anything about fishing. But what does Peter say? I love it. He says, because you say so, I will. Because you say so, I will. This is the commitment of a follower of Jesus. I don't like it. I don't like it always. But because you say so, I will. So be followers. Are you a follower of Jesus? I know a lot of people are admirers of Jesus. A lot of people love Jesus. You get in a tight spot. Who else's number would you want to have in your phone, right? I want to be all about Jesus when, someone I care about is sick or in need. Are you a follower? Have you yielded? Because you say so, I will. And then last then, what's the mission? Jesus says, follow me and I will what? I will make you a fisherman who catches people. What an amazing, what a beautiful metaphor. Because in the Old Testament, the whole picture of the sea was dark. It was like the denizen of the evil one. It was the place of chaos and darkness. and the Jews, they were not a seafaring people. That was the Phoenicians. The Jews were a nomadic, shepherding kind of people. The sea to the Jews, it was terrifying. It was violent. It represented darkness. And so to pull something out of the darkness, what a beautiful metaphor, right? Jesus said to these fishermen, instead of pulling fish out of there, you're going to pull out of their people. You're going to pull people out of brokenness and darkness and hopelessness and rescue them and bring them to God. You're going to bring them to them life and hope and health. And so here's the deal. If Jesus has summoned you, and if you have said, yes, sir, this is your calling, this is your mission, are you? Are you on mission? You ever heard of Moberg? Moberg. Moberg was a catcher, a baseball catcher. He was from that almost mythical era of baseball where you had players like Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. The amazing thing about Moberg was he was somewhat known, but he was a terrible catcher. I mean, just flat out horrible. He wasn't good at throwing out runners. He was even worse as a batter. But Moberg was unique among baseball players. You know, if you were a baseball catcher back in that era in particular, they didn't get paid any money to play baseball. Basically, you're just a tobacco-chewing, groveling in the dirt catcher. Catcher was usually just the biggest kid in the neighborhood. But you know, the amazing thing about Moberg is that the players said there was never anybody like him. Moberg knew like 15 languages. Moberg read 10 newspapers every morning. Moberg graduated magna cum laude from Princeton. He got a law degree from Columbia, and he studied at the Sorbonne. He was a baseball catcher and a spy. You see, before there was a CIA, Moberg worked in the intelligence services in the United States. So he got added to the team when the U.S. baseball team started touring Japan before the war. Only Moberg went to the hospital in Tokyo because it was, in fact, the tallest building there, and he took pictures. He took pictures of the harbor and the rail yard and the military installations, the very pictures that one day were handed to a man named Jimmy Doolittle, who took off with 16 bombers off the aircraft carrier, the Hornet, striking back at Japan after Pearl Harbor. And actually, I get a kick out of this. He went on a baseball tour of Norway on that one day of the year where it's warm enough to play baseball in Norway. And while in Norway, he took pictures of the Nazi heavy water plant there where they were working on developing an atomic bomb. And when later the RAF fighters of Winston Churchill targeted that plant, one of the very first targets of World War II, all based on his pictures that he took as a spy. You see, Moberg was a baseball player, but he had a higher mission, didn't he? He was fighting to rid the world of evil, to set the world free. You know what? Some of you are teachers. Some of you are in the building trades and labor. Some of you are in management. Some of you run small business. Some of you are in real estate and banking and financial services. Some of you are nurses. Some of you are homemakers. Many of you are retired. All that, do all that. Do all that for the glory of God. But that's always part of what? That's all part of the mission. You are fishermen. Every single person in this room who is a follower of Jesus has been called to be a fisher of men. You're a fisherman who catches people. You wade into the darkness. You wade into the darkness, and out of the darkness you come with people who need life. And I have to tell you, I love the way several of you have caught the mission. I love the way that you invite your neighbors and your friends to worship, just loving your neighbors and inviting them to church. I love the way that you've started Bible studies and moms groups in your neighborhoods, just reaching out to your neighbors with the love of Jesus. I love the way that you serve and mentor at-risk kids at the Bradley Center. I love the way that you get excited about supporting mission trips and teams who spread the love of Jesus to every corner of the world. Well, there it is. That's what it means to be a fisher of men. It's hard. It's gritty. It's hard work walking into the darkness, but you're fishing. You're fishing. What a calling, right? To bait hooks with the grace of God and watch God summon women, men, and children to himself. For 2,000 years, people have heard Jesus say, come. Come follow me. And they have. They followed. They didn't know where in the world it would take them, but they followed. Like Roddy Edmonds. Roddy Edmonds, he didn't know where it would take him. Roddy Edmonds was a devout Christ follower from the hills of Tennessee. He ends up in the U.S. military. He gets sent into action in the Battle of the Bulge, where he was then captured and put in a German prison camp, where he then spends the next 5 months of the war. And most of the men there in that installation, they lost between 50 and 70 pounds to survive. Over that period of time, there were 1,300 U.S. prisoners in that installation, and Roddy Edmonds happened to be the highest ranking officer. And as the war was winding down, the commandant of that camp gave an order. The order was that every Jewish American prisoner had to turn out in the yard the next morning. I mean, it was common for every prisoner to turn out, you know, that was able. Physically, of course, but on this morning, he called only the Jewish American prisoners, and everybody knew what was going on. This was a last-ditch effort by the Germans to eradicate the Jews, to target the Jews, to give the Jews, you know, the worst work assignments or whatever that would lead quickly to their demise. And so Edmonds now has 1,300 soldiers at his command. And just try to imagine that, the context. Imagine the dire situation where they're tempted to fight over every little bit of food, just trying to survive. Everybody's just trying to make it home. Everybody's just focused on their own best interest, right? But then he declares the next morning that every single man is going to turn out on that yard. Every single one of them. And do you know? That 1,297 soldiers showed up the next morning, all standing there in perfect military formation. They emptied the infirmary. They carried guys out there. Every single American in the camp showed up. And when the commandant came out, he was furious. He said, I just want the Jews. I just want the Jews. And Roddy Edmonds said, the Geneva Convention, Article 17, says you only offer your name, your rank, your serial number. That's all we're required to offer you. The commandant then said, listen, my order to you is very clear, just the Jews. And Edmonds looked him right in the face and said, sir, we're all Jews here. And the commandant then pulled out his Luger and he pushed it right into his forehead. And he said, in just a minute, I'm going to pull this trigger. Unless you give the order for all the Jews in your midst to step out. And Edmund said, go ahead and shoot. And after you kill me, you're going to have to kill these other 1,297 guys here as well. And when this war is over, you will be a war criminal, sir. And you will be held accountable for every one of these soldiers' lives. So go ahead. Do as you please. And the commandant backed down. Roddy Edmonds was recently honored at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, the preeminent Holocaust museum in all the world, for being a righteous one among the nations. He is one of only four Americans. He's the only U.S. soldier because he was willing to give up his life for the beleaguered Jews, all because he was a Christian. Because as a young man, Jesus crossed his path and said to Roddy Edmonds, come, follow me. And he said, yes, sir, I will. We walk in great company, brothers and sisters, being invited with thousands all over the world to be followers of Jesus? Are you? Are you? Have you heard the summons? Are you a follower? Can I just tell you something? It's the greatest life. It's the greatest life there is. So go, follow Jesus. And while you're at it, go fish. Let's pray. Well, Lord, we thank you that you don't choose the prime, and you don't just choose the rich and the intelligent, and that, you know, you don't distribute your grace and love and favor the way that we distribute our grace and love and favor upon the prominent. But we thank you that you choose people like us, people who would seem to be the least likely, and you walked right in the midst of our lives and said, follow me. And Lord, there are people in this room today, or even hearing this message, who need to make that decision. And I pray that you, by your Holy Spirit, would enable them to respond and say, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And to drop this silly idea that they're in charge and become followers and to begin the great adventure of being your disciple. May it be so. May it be so today. For we ask this prayer in the name of him who taught us to pray, saying, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us of our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power. I'd invite you to stand if you're able. We'll close with singing hymn number 378, Make Me a Captive, Lord, 378.